The Hard Shoulder on Newstalk.
With Nissan Subscribe and Drive. No deposit, no compromise, no fuss. Find out more at nissan.ie.
Right now, though, the US House of Representatives impeached Donald Trump, President Donald Trump, yesterday, remarkably for a second time, just days before he is scheduled to leave office. The House voted 232 to 197 to impeach the president. 10 members of the Republican Party joined the Democrats. One of those Democrats was Richard E. Neal. He's a U.S. congressman. He's chairman of the Friends of Ireland caucus in the United States House of Representatives. And he joins me now on the line. Congressman Neal, it is good to speak to you on the Hard Shoulder. Before we talk about impeachment and the president and what happened last night and what happened next, let's go back in time a few days, back to Wednesday of last week. How did those remarkable, incredible events unfold from your perspective?
Well, as irony would have it, I was in my office, which is in the Capitol, just literally a few feet from the floor of the House of Representatives, and maybe 15 feet from what is known as Statuary Hall and the Great Rotunda. And I had scheduled a call at 1:30 to speak with Brandon Lewis, the Secretary of State for Northern Ireland. And as you know, we held firm in our position here through the Friends of Ireland and the Speaker on the issue of the border. And once the final Brexit agreement had been reached and the border issue had been resolved, making sure that there was no restoration of a border, we were talking about the potential for a UK-US trade agreement. And as you know, we made clear to them that there could be no trade agreement with the UK if, in fact, there'd been any jeopardy created about a return of the border between the Republic and the North. And the conversation actually went very well. I think the two of us were very satisfied with at least the outcome as it relates to the border issue. And I all of a sudden said to him, I said, I'm getting some signals here, hand signals from my staff, that there's a tumultuous crowd outside that is trying to come up the stairs, which surprised me because I've never seen that before. And sure enough, they did come up the stairs and they broke windows in my office and they were marauding through the hallways. And my office has this very, very large and very heavy table, which can seat up to 18 people. And six of us, including three Capitol Police officers, myself, we picked up the table and we put it against the door. We put chairs against the windows and the Capitol Police that were with us, three of them, they drew their guns. So it was very unsettling for all of us. It was an experience I hope I'll never have again. And it represented the most serious assault on the Capitol itself since the Brits burned the Capitol in the War of 1812.
Well, did it take the cessation of all of this for you to absorb what happened? Or was there a moment in the middle of it where you stood back and realized, my God, I've barricaded myself in my office. There are armed police with their firearms drawn and there are marauding protesters at my door. Like, did it sink in while it was happening? Exactly, the scale of it.
Yeah, I think it's important to understand that I recognized the scale of it. And when I was watching the door almost bow as it was being pushed and shoved and pounded on, and they were announcing that they were on the Ways and Means Committee, which is my office there in the Capitol. But there was no panic on my part, nor was there any of the others, the Capitol Police that were there and my staffers. We were pretty steadfast. There was no hand-wringing. We just thought we had to wait out what they were doing. And sure enough, after about 40 minutes, we were escorted through a tear-gassed hallway from the rotunda to Statuary Hall, down these cavernous staircases in the Capitol. Remember, the Capitol is ancient by American standards. And we were able to get an escort over to a safe environment where we stayed for 4 hours. And one of the things I think that is pretty durable about our democracy and we should remind people of, we went back into that chamber that evening and cast our votes on the basis of reaffirming the election of Joe Biden.
A lot of people have said like they were shocked but not surprised by what happened, that what happened last Wednesday week was the natural culmination of everything that's been building and has been driven on and encouraged by the sitting president over the last few years. Are you in that category? Were you shocked but not surprised?
I'm not surprised, and I also would say that this has gone on for a long period of time in America. There are many of these groups, and it dates back in some cases decades with some of these campaigns that have been run. They're reckless, they're chaotic, and they're irresponsible. In addition to which, I think that social media amplifies conflict. I think that more and more media have gone to choose a side journalism. And I think that these groups have all figured out how to get their message out as they recruit. It's my understanding that when they send out a message on social media, that they can recruit hundreds, if not thousands, of people within a matter of minutes who sit and listen to this vile castigation every day of representative democracy here in America. So my own sense is it's a recklessness that's been reinforced by these irresponsible outlets and confirmed by people who now tune into news that agree with them rather than vice versa.
Do you place more of the blame on the media than the president?
No, I don't. I think that the president understood the vehicle of Twitter and how it quickly could arouse passions. And I think that his ability to communicate with people directly, as he said, yeah, I don't need a filter. And he surprised, if not stunned, everybody, literally in his first day or so in office, when all of a sudden he started tweeting out these messages that in some cases were reckless, irresponsible, and bordered on almost a contempt for our democratic norms and representative democracy. So I think he figured out how to use the platforms. And I think the battle now is because we value free speech so much in America, we don't want to jeopardize that. And at the same time, these groups are using these free speech opportunities on these platforms to recruit more and more menacing people.
That is a tricky one, isn't it, Congressman? Because a lot of people will have welcomed the deplatforming, if you call it that, of Donald Trump on a lot of social media platforms. At the same time, they'll feel a bit uncomfortable that it's the social media platforms themselves who are the ones doing the deplatforming. Like, you know, it's a version of, you know, today they came from my neighbor, tomorrow they come
from
me.
Yeah, I'm very mindful of that. And very skeptical of some of the suggestions that have come forward, because I do think that the genius of our First Amendment, which is the cornerstone of our democracy, the genius of our First Amendment is that it guarantees a second opinion. And I think that we need to be very careful as we go down any pathway that we're jeopardize what we believe has been this liberty ensconced notion of our constitutional protection. So I think that the argument is not as simple as just cultural moderation. I think that many of these platforms have become indeed very, very reckless. What to do about them, I'm not so sure.
To bring it back then to the sitting president, to Donald Trump, did you feel you had no choice but to vote for impeachment last night?
I did, and I felt that way actually from last Wednesday when we began to talk about the proposals that we had for censure. We talked about invoking the 25th Amendment, and then we talked about impeachment. Impeachment is a constitutional remedy, and impeachment ensures that for those of us who sit in the legislative body of the government, the House and the Senate, that we reminded by Article 1 of our constitutional system that we're the first branch of government, and that presidents serve like we do at the will of the people, but unlike some of the European notions, we don't have that old argument about divine right. The Congress is supposed to check the executive, and we're supposed to do it vigorously. That's our responsibility, to make sure that no part of the federal government ever becomes too strong.
There's a counter argument that's made to that. It's not a constitutional argument. It's not a legal argument. It's more a political one. And it's that, you know, Donald Trump is gone in a few days, and that impeaching him, you feed into his narrative, a narrative that he wallows in, that he is a victim, that he is a victim of the witch hunt, the greatest witch hunt in the history of politics, as he likes to say. Have you any truck with that argument?
I think that the better argument here is that all of a sudden he started to suggest that he wanted an end to any violence. If he had said that the day before or from July of last year when he first started to purport that the election was rigged, I don't think we would have had the same outcome on January 6th. Instead, he became more vigorous in suggesting, as the polls began to tell us that he was going to lose the election, that the election was rigged. I mean, there is such a thing as an honest disagreement. What there cannot be an honest disagreement about in America in this election cycle was Joe Biden won this election comfortably. Mm-hmm. We've had examples where Al Gore conceded after losing a 5-4 decision in the Supreme Court. Richard Nixon had to read Jack Kennedy's name back in 1960 as the winner of that election. We established a precedent in 1800 when John Adams lost the election to Thomas Jefferson. We established the idea that there would be a peaceful transition of power. And this is the only time in our history, despite some difficult moments, that we had almost a popular uprising by Trump supporters whom he encouraged.
What happens next in terms of the impeachment? It goes to the Senate. Now, is there any realistic hope that there will be enough Republicans who will vote with the Democrats in the Senate?
You would have to have 17. And for the moment, I think that the leadership of Mitch McConnell will have much to do with that. There are a series of engaging stories that appeared in the New York Times during the last 72 hours, suggesting that McConnell might be open to conviction. Remember that what you witnessed yesterday was indictment.
Yeah.
It now goes to the full jury, the United States Senate. And I think that the Republicans right now are in the midst of this significant schism within their party. And that is, how do they rid themselves of Trumpism
for
future elections? And I think that that's the dilemma that McConnell feels, even though there's a large base of Republicans across the country who are okay with Trump. I'm not going to say that they're enthusiastic about him, but they are okay with him.
Okay.
The problem with that is that if you're McConnell and you want to look to a more representative Republican Party that once existed, can you do it if you still have Trump out there working on the fringes?
Well, listen, it's been really, really interesting speaking to you, and hopefully we will speak again soon. U.S. Congressman Richard E. Neal, chairman of the Friends of Ireland Caucus in the U.S. House of Representatives.